Welcome to Policy Chats, the official podcast of the School of Public Policy at the University of California, Riverside. I'm your host, Kevin Karami. Join me and my classmates as we learn about potential policy solutions for today's biggest societal challenges. Joining us today is water law partner Wesley Miliband. My fellow classmate Catherine Ma and I chatted with him about California's water crisis.
Thank you so much, Mr. Miliband, for joining us on the podcast today. It's an honor to have you on. We actually haven't done an episode on water policy specifically on Policy Chats. We've had some episodes cover environmental policy in general, but I think water, especially in California, given the situation we're in, is so important to talk about. And so that being said, I want to jump straight into the topic. I thought it'd be great if we can maybe start with an overview of the water crisis. I think a lot of people have heard about, you know, California water being a major issue, a pressing issue, but I think our audience could really benefit from learning about why this is a crisis and why there are so many policy experts and researchers and everyone in Sacramento talking about this. You know, why is water such a major talking point in California politics and policy?
Well, thank you, Kevin, and good afternoon to everyone. It's a real pleasure to be here for multiple reasons, one being a UC Riverside graduate myself and having really this excellent forum that's hosted by not only the university and the School of Public Policy, but terrific students who I've come to know a bit here that make me a proud alum. So thank you for the good work that's being done by you and by the podcast, by the Public Policy School, and ultimately UC Riverside. So Kevin, to the question of an overview about California and the state of a water crisis and really what I'm hearing from you, why is this so pressing? Well, number one, when I hear crisis, it's alarming. And the one thing I like to be cautious about is not being an alarmist to where we ring the bell too strongly or too often, because then people can have a tendency to become accustomed to that and then not really want to respond. So even if they wanted to respond and did respond, we need to be cautious. Now, that's not to say we don't have a crisis. I would like to, I do think we have dire situations. It does vary a little bit throughout the state. So what I'd like to do is almost just give some data that I pulled up. And often what you'll hear me say when it's not speaking as the lawyer in referring to regulations or laws, or even really policy undertones and policy intent behind laws, you'll hear a lot of science, because science is so much of what drives California water, both in terms of just the natural science to it and the solutions that can be engineered, often are scientifically based. But let's take a look what we have abundantly out there within the headline news. Reservoir levels in these current events demonstrate there's a serious water supply problem in California. When you look at the various reservoirs from the north end of the state of Lake Shasta all the way down to the San Diego border there of California and Mexico, you're going to see reservoirs, almost all, I haven't checked in the last few days, but almost all of them below the halfway mark and some significantly below that halfway mark. And that's disturbing. And what's interesting in looking at the data is we just finished what's called the water year. California has a water year, much like there's a fiscal year for companies. There's the calendar year, obviously, that we're used to. The water year runs from October 1st through September 30th. And what we know now, based on the data, is that 2020 through 2022, which just ended at the end of last month, a few weeks ago, those were the driest 3 years on record. And that surpasses what was previously the driest 3 years, which was only a number of years ago in our most recent drought. And those were years 2013 to 2015. And they've been recording this data since 1895. So what that means is California's driest 6 years over an approximately 128 years that they've been recording, or we as a state have been recording precipitation, which is the snow and the rainfall. Six of those years have just happened in the last 10 years alone. So I think it's a fair characterization to say that we're in a very serious, dire crisis type of situation. And to give a little more perspective of what the circumstances mean on the ground for people is that the supply challenges vary, as I mentioned, in different regions. So there are regions of the state where conservation is working effectively, both because the water agencies, whether it's cities, water districts, or on the farming side, there were farmers using good conservation efficiency methods. Sometimes the conservation is enough to help get through a dry year, maybe even multiple dry years, but there is no silver magic bullet or solution. And the conservation alone is not working in multiple areas throughout the state. But it's even more dire for others where they don't even have enough supply, either because of quality contaminations that are either human caused or naturally occurring in surface or groundwater. So there's low supplies where conservation is not enough to get out of the situation, even for that year. And then the environment becomes impacted too, as well, as there's less flows in the streams and rivers. Temperatures tend to go up. That can create lethal temperatures for fish. It can create bacteria, which is now something that downstream water users have to be mindful of and treating and so forth for their drinking water supply. So really what this all means to me is the water supply challenges have become so pressing because of the frequency in which we have dry years and they're back to back. And I'm hearing from experts who really know this stuff on the hydrology side that this winter is forecasted to be another dry winter. So that's looking like we're going into maybe a fourth year of dry conditions. So really what this all comes down to in my mind is the hydrologic cycle, which is, can be talked about in different ways, whether it's the climate cycle, but essentially, the rain and the snow fall and it comes down, it evaporates, it almost goes in a circular fashion. And I'm kind of butchering how a scientist would explain that, but that's kind of my simple understanding. But that, tends to be like the economy with ups and downs, and it's inevitable, but it's just as the ocean ebbs and flows. And we need to identify how best the science, as best as we can with the science we have, as to what that pattern will be, so that we're not always in a reactionary mode and we can be more proactive. And there are good proactive efforts going on, but to up our game essentially to the next level.
Yes, thank you. And it's really a great understanding of how the water crisis is such a pressing issue in California and addressing the alarmist tendencies. So I wanted to kind of ask now how you talked a little bit about understanding these low reservoir levels and numbers and reporting even the driest years. So what are the key logistic challenges that we face and how did each challenge grow to where it is today?
Well, that's great. Thank you, Catherine. So I think it would help here to give a little background about California's water supply. Approximately 2/3 of the supply originates in Northern California, but approximately 2/3 of the state's population lives in Southern California. And the line for what is Southern California could be drawn differently, but for the most part, it's most regions near or just south of the Tehachapi Mountains as you're crossing from the north part of the state where I am into Los Angeles County. So the water supply itself, I think, is also important to understand because you have most of the water originating in Northern California, most of it used in Southern, but the supply itself consists of surface and groundwater. So it helps to have a little understanding about that to understand logistical challenges and then ultimately how to identify solutions and try to implement those. And so the water supply consists of surface water and groundwater. There's recycled and desalination and some others that are in some of the regional or local portfolios. But the vast, vast majority of California water supply comes from surface water and groundwater, which are essentially fed by snow and rainfall. So during normal years of snow and rainfall, the estimates are that groundwater is relied on for about 30% of the supply. And during the dry years, it's up to about 60% of the supply. And that's more or less how things worked for decades. But in recent years, and even the last decade, maybe even up to two decades, that's been changing for a number of reasons, the patterns, the regulations, et cetera. One other thing I want to add before I really identify logistical challenges is that how the water supply is used is important to understand, too. So often you might hear about, farming uses this amount or cities use this amount. At the end of the day, what I've seen is consistent numbers that give me confidence in being able to say this here on this forum and platform is that think of it as a pie. We have a water pie, and 50% of that water supply goes for environmental purposes, whether that's required by a court decision, federal or state, whether that's required by a governmental agency, typically federal or state, to keep more water in the rivers, help the fisheries, the habitat, et cetera. And then there are voluntary programs such as habitat conservation plans, or HCPs, as they're known as. So that's about 50% of the supply right there. Of the remaining supply, then, out of that 50%, you have, well, let me keep it in whole numbers. So out of the whole pie, 50% is environment. 40% is for farming irrigation needs. So basically, especially when you drive from Southern California up through the state and you see all of the farms, that's 40% of our water supply that's helping to feed the state, the nation, and parts of the world. The 10%, this number was a little surprising when I first learned it. 10% is for actual municipal use. So what you have coming out of the taps at your home, or the domestic well owner who lives in a rural area and operates their own well for their household needs. You know, and commercial industrial uses like the malls and some industrial plants, that's only about 10%. And so that's good to understand where it's coming from, where it's going, what it's made up of, and how it's used. So with that, you know, logistical challenges, how do you get water from Northern California to Southern California and everything in between, and from the coast to inland? That's the logistical challenge as I see it, even though there are projects in place. And that, I think, is really a testament to good foresight that was done by the federal and state governments going back now close to 100 years for the federal government. So we have what's called the Central Valley Project, and we have at the state level, the State Water Project. The federal government built the Central Valley Project in the 1930s. The State Water Project was built in the 1960s. And it's basically what I like to think of as an elegant collection of water systems with reservoirs around the state that release water into rivers, release it into canals, and basically have a very logical, built by engineers, very logical system that moves the water from point A to point B, sometimes hundreds of miles. And that, to me, is an incredible feat in and of itself and worthy of its own topic. But with that is our logistical challenges. Having to account, much like a bank account, when you make a deposit and a withdrawal. So the water is deposited into the reservoir, rain, falls, snow melt, runoff, et cetera. And so there's the deposit, the withdrawal becomes the releases. Now, tracking that water, we don't trace molecules of water typically. So to trace a block of water is a logistical challenge. And that's what the operators of these systems have to do. And they seem to do it pretty well. There's going to be some water that just gets lost to evaporation, seepage into the ground, et cetera. But that's a logistical challenge, is tracking that water. How much is getting from point A to point B? Is it going as intended? How much is lost to the evaporation versus, you know, how much is lost to seepage? So massive issues there to have to contend with. I would say that there are some others, and certainly not enough time to cover them all. But I think at a more micro level would be, say, the landowner, whether for their own domestic needs or the farmer, you know, not having enough of a water supply or enough funding to be able to put a pump next to the river to pump water out for their needs, or to have a pump and a motor to have a well that might have to go down 1,000 feet into the ground to pull up water. So at a very macro level, you have these projects. At a very micro level, you have these real needs, and both exist. And it's a reality, and that's what leads to probably some other questions you have. But I would lay those two things out there as massive logistical challenges. And very quickly, what do these stem from, or why have they grown, I think, is what you asked, Catherine. And I would just quickly say that our population growth is a massive contributor. I did pull up some numbers recently. I was curious about this in a different context. And in 1930, it's reported that our state's population was 5.6 million people. 1990, it was up to 29.7 million people. And now, toward the end of 2022, it's just under 40 million people. So we are a growth-intense state. And existing infrastructure on top of that has aged. So I think those are two huge contributors to why existing logistical challenge become even more challenging.
Join us November 30th when Dr. Robert Simmons, head of social impact for Micron Technology, will share how his father's incarceration and former middle school students in Detroit and DC inform his thinking on racial justice, education policy, and philanthropy. To learn more, you could go to spp.ucr.edu. You can also find the RSVP link in our show notes.
I love the way you put it, how the macro issues with the water project and actually getting water from the north to the south, and how important that is. And I love how you've noted the fact that most of the water is in the north, but most of the people are in the south, and that is in itself presents a massive an issue. And the fact that it's been so many years since we've been as a state, both the federal government and our own state government has been working to try and you know, address this issue. And also when you hear the state population growing so much, you know, it really all comes together, and population growth is such a fascinating topic in and of itself. You know, one thing that I think is also really interesting to talk about is the policy perspective on this. You know, obviously, like you mentioned before, the science behind it is really important. You know, how would, you know, an engineer actually, you know, get water from, you know, the north to the south, or the scientific issues behind it, or, you know, new research being done on, for example, on desal to try and figure out how to more make that process more efficient. Those are all really important. But then on the other side, you have the policy aspect, and the you know, and also in many cases the legal issues that policymakers may face. So, what kinds of policy and legal issues has California run into recently, or maybe even in the past? You know, why have these issues come up, and how do we overcome them? You know, I think it's really important that, you know, we talk about both sides of it too, because even if the science is there, if the policymakers and those in office aren't supporting it, then the science doesn't really actually get applied in the real world. So can you maybe speak about the policy side of this issue?
Sure. Thanks, Kevin. So I'm hearing that, and please feel free to jump in and correct me or add to it, but it's a great topic. And the questions I'm hearing that try to compartmentalize is essentially the kinds of policy and legal issues that are essentially like hurdles or impediments that we need to overcome to get to an end goal. And, you know, so part of that is understanding the root cause, like what's causing these or what's the stem for it. And I like that because it helps. That tends to be the way I think, is what's our goal? What are the different strategies of getting there? And then more tactically, what do you do to get there? And so I think the goal is to try to maximize use of our limited resource of water. And there are a lot of great things being done, but in terms of policy and different challenges and the legal side, you know, I'll try to provide a garden variety of what I think are policy and legal, or some combination of the two. And one thing I'll just candidly say is, you know, that I try to do my job as a practicing lawyer is to be very mindful that my job is as legal counsel, whether it's advisory behind the scenes or in a boardroom with elected officials or in a courtroom. And I'm not the policymaker, but it's hard to always have just a black and white delineation there, because the two do blend. There are legal issues that have policy implications. There are policy decisions that have legal implications. And a quick example is that the law requires under SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, that basins be brought into balance by 2040. So that's the law. Now policies have to be set within the boundaries of the law. Now let's even take that SGMA example and flip it on its head to have a policy that has legal implications. So let's say you have that local agency that wants to do a good project to help bring the basins back into balance and have water injected or percolate into the basin so that it's recharging that basin, helping to bring up the levels. Well, to do that, someone who's willing to provide water, assuming they have it to provide, would likely want to be able to know that that water can be used for its needs down the road. And so you get into a lot of water rights issues I won't bore you all with, but I'll just say simply, you know, where my mind goes is that it would need to be very clear from that policy decision being made that there are legal implications to not have that water deemed abandoned, donated, forfeited, you know, but abandoned and forfeiture are the two legal terms of art that have distinct applications. So as part of that, you would want to have the water deemed a beneficial use for recharge. And that's sometimes easier said than done, but that's at least issue spotting something that would need to be done on the legal side to help implement that policy. But getting more specific into the policy and legal issues and some of the hurdles that I see based on my observations from time to time, you know, we talked about North and South, and with that is a longstanding mentality. I'm a Southern California native, but I've lived here in Northern California for 8 years, absolutely love different things about our wonderful state. So it's a diverse state in many ways, but there is a longstanding mentality of North versus South or South versus North, or even just water it down a little bit, I guess, pun intended, that it's North and South. There is that mentality out there when you get into the water discussions, whether it's a policy discussion, a political campaign, a legal dispute, and from the lawyer's perspective in the legal dispute is what's called area of origin rights. So there's actually going to the question or the part of the question about where does this stem from? It stems from a lot of its personal ideologies that people have or philosophies or political affiliations. I'm not getting into any of that stuff. That's not my role. But as the lawyer, you know, there are area of origin rights. So if two-thirds of that supply is originating in Northern California and there's protections to make sure that water is used where it originates with surplus or extra water available to go elsewhere, that's a good general public policy in my view, but it's much more difficult when it's actually applied. So that to me, I would just boil it down to a North and South mentality. And how do you overcome that? A North-South mentality that in part is caused by personal views and or certain legal requirements that exist. And how do you overcome that, I think, is by having more storage and some things that we might talk about later, but other water-oriented solutions that help eliminate the intensity or the magnitude of those different causes, so that, okay, area of origin doesn't become a focal point. Let's just change that. Well, that you're upending the water rights system, and I'm not an advocate of that whatsoever. I think that creates a whole host of other problems. Another big thing I'd like to touch on is energy nexus. So we hear about water, we hear about energy, we hear about renewable energy. Now, water takes a ton of energy to move around. So you have not traditional as in coal-fired, but traditional energy with natural gas that a lot of our power plants are operated by, generating electricity for our use. Well, similarly, you know, that's needed for moving water around, or diesel is used on a farm. If it's not electrical, it's diesel. But at the macro scale of things, a lot of energy is needed to move that water, especially over mountain ranges. In fact, if you drive Interstate 5 south and you come to those Tehachapi Mountains to cross into Los Angeles County, some of you might have noticed off to the right, and I've pointed this out to my family from time to time, and they just roll their eyes at me, but that's okay. It's just the water guru in me. But you'll see the massive pipes that are part of the State Water Project moving water from up north over the mountains. That takes a lot of energy to move through there. So energy is a big part of this topic. It's deserving of its own discussion and rounds of discussions, but it's good to flag here as trying to identify policy and or legal things that exist to being able to have efficient use of water and enough water. But hydropower, I'm a huge advocate of. I like how there are different hydropower projects throughout the state that are part of either an investor-owned utility or public utilities. There are some irrigation districts that have their own hydropower facilities, and they go through the federal process for those things. So hydropower is a good, clean way. But the real question, I think the policy hurdle, and I don't know how to overcome this, is this is what a lot of very smart people would try to figure out, is can renewable energy such as wind and solar generate enough power and be stored adequately enough to move the water around that needs to be moved, such as over those big mountains. So that's, I'm just flagging an issue to which I don't think there's any clear solution yet, and the science might not be there yet, but something to keep an eye on. Another impediment that I see is let's apply existing law, such as using an example of what's in our California Water Code for conserving water. We hear about conservation, and Water Code Section 1011 explicitly says, so the legislature has spoken, it was signed into law, I think decades ago, probably 20 to 30 years ago, to basically say conserved water is available to be leased or sold. So what that means to me as a practitioner is that if there's a client that can demonstrate with a sound methodology that they have conserved water, and they have a willing buyer of that water who needs it, and they have the revenue to pay for it. I mean, look at our drought times. This is a real world scenario that exists and happens. Then that water should be made available to transfer, or at least is available to transfer. I don't want to say should, that's the policy decision to be made, but it's legally available. The problem becomes an application is that, at the state level, not every state agency might agree with that. And so I'll just kind of leave it at that, is that conserved water is an area that is available to be able to provide in, say, a dry year to someone else. But it doesn't always get done that way. And there's different reasons for that. So that's an area where I see a hurdle. It could be overcome probably by getting the right people in the right room at the right time to agree this is what the law says. Here's a sound methodology. That water is needed by them. That revenue that comes in helps this agency keep its rates low for customers, have revenue for repair projects, that sort of thing. So a win-win can exist. And that's a good example of a hurdle, the reason for it, and how to try to overcome it. One last tidbit I'll leave there on this policy issue is floodwaters. When it rains, it pours. It's almost like that old Morton Salt commercial from a long time ago. So when our reservoirs are getting so full, believe it or not, when there are intense storm events, the water is released so that there's not a flood. But if we don't have the ability to capture that water to put into the ground or put into a different holding reservoir of some sort, then it literally flows out to the ocean. And, that's unfortunate because that is water that could be banked and saved for that later time. So I think the connection between floodwaters and really these times of limited water can be better bridged if we have that infrastructure there. So I'll pause with that. Thanks.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Miliband. And I really like how you explain these issues and how to try and combat these hurdles, like you said, as you describe them as hurdles. And I understand how you describe the policy and legal side as it can be black and white, but really in the end, they need to blend together for the end goals. So now I wanted to kind of, since we've addressed the policy and legal issues and talked about like the origins, as you explained, I wanted to ask, coming from an infrastructure and funding perspective, what does California need to meet this demand?
Right. Well, that's a great question. I pause and I chuckle a little because I don't know that there's any single answer, number one, from a single person. And when you ask, if you were to poll a number of people, you'd probably get different answers. When you ask me, I think there's multiple components to it. It's like I said before, we can't just conserve our way out of drought. That's reactionary, number one, even though it's good. And I think for the most part, folks have learned to do that. But that's only one component to it. And so with that, I think with infrastructure, there's a good example that's coming back as a project now, and it's called the Delta Conveyance Project. Its prior iteration a few years ago, about 6 years ago, was known as California Water Fix. Prior to that, it was the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. Prior to that, and I think it was the first iteration of now four, was CalFed. The idea was to build the massive infrastructure that it would take to be able to have redundancy, maybe greater efficiency to move water from Northern to Southern California. And so you'll sometimes hear twin tunnels. That's referring to California Water Fix. Single tunnel is what's now becoming a Delta Conveyance Project. And California Department of Water Resources currently has a draft environmental impact report out on the street with a comment deadline later this year, sometime in mid-December. And so that's an example of infrastructure that the state is essentially putting out there as a project that can help alleviate much of California's problems. Now, one might ask, it's on its fourth iteration, you say? And please call me Wes. Wes, it's on its fourth iteration? Yes, it is. And why is that? Well, this almost goes back to the prior question, different hurdles. I think a lot of times there's an issue of education, sometimes a component to where we need better public outreach for people to understand, agencies to understand, environmental groups, whatever it might be, whether it's the regulators at the federal and state level, the local public agencies, the irrigation districts, farmers, environmental groups, north, south, all around, and individuals like yourself and institutions on the academia side. So I think part of it's educational. I think part of it's trust building. That will never go away, no matter how, in my mind, it will never go away. However much we can advance technology and have efficiently run, podcasts such as this one, trust is still a fundamental necessity, I think, to getting things done. So more specific now to infrastructure and funding, bringing that back to this Delta Conveyance Project. It's been estimated to be $16 or $17 billion to construct the project. Some have said $20 billion, this with a B. So that's a massive project at a massive price tag. And that's part of the reason it's probably had challenges, plus the different stakeholders and their different interests and concerns about, well, how is this going to impact my supply, this, that, and the next thing. So that is, maybe that's too big of a project. I'm not opining on whether it's good or bad, right or wrong, too big or too small, but it's certainly big and will definitely generate. And I think you're in a fascinating position to observe how California policy is being made by having this project and the legal process that goes with it, with CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, being what's in play right now for that draft environmental impact report. And then from there, there's regulatory processes going to the State Water Resources Control Board. So it would be a fascinating exercise if it was 25 plus years ago and I was in school, to be able to see this and observe California history in the making. Not knowing what the result is going to be is all the more suspenseful. But I do think taking into consideration other infrastructure projects other than, a massive one like the DCP would be developing recycled water systems. Some cities and water districts around our state have that. And you'll notice them by the purple pipes. That purple pipes are required by regulation so that it's, and signage, signs to go with it to warn that it's not potable drinking water. But that is a good, in my opinion, efficient use of water resources, very expensive to build. But nonetheless, recycled water systems are a great example of infrastructure. And from the funding perspective for that, similar to DCP, it's often done and funded or subsidized by the public. And whether it's a bond, which is almost like a credit card, basically, to raise that money and then be able to get it back through the sales of water over the long term, much would be the same for the ratepayers in that city or that water district's customer base to be paying for. And it also, but the flip side is that it helps create water security by conserving the potable water for the indoor use. And instead, and while still having the green and lush areas, you know, for the city parkways and those types of things. I think other infrastructure that comes to mind is injection wells, such as when I was talking about floodwaters, have that pump that can just take right off the river, assuming it's not violating some environmental rule or something to that effect. You go through all the approvals, do the lawyer thing, but from a policy perspective, be able to have that infrastructure there that would be able to divert the water and let it percolate into the ground, whether it's by injection or literally Mother Nature, you know, have the water just by gravity eventually get into the groundwater basin. So those were a few examples, the big one of DCP, recycled water, and injection wells.
Social injustice, health disparities, climate change. Are you interested in solving pressing challenges like these currently facing our region and the world? Then consider joining the next cohort of future policy leaders like me by applying for the UCR Master of Public Policy program. Learn more at mpp.ucr.edu. You can also find the link in our show notes.
Thank you so much, Mr. Miliband. I think infrastructure is such an interesting topic in this, in the water discussion, because, you know, you kind of touched on it earlier as well with the logistical challenges of actually getting water from the north to the south, and how moving water in and of itself is such a challenge. Talking about the infrastructure and mentioning how even if a solution, you know, if an engineering or scientific solution exists, if there isn't, you know, if there isn't funding for it on a large scale, it doesn't really go anywhere. And so I think it's a really important topic to talk about, because just because a solution, you know, theoretically exists or exists on paper, it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, the feasibility of it in the real world is an entirely different, you know, conversation on its own. I also did want to ask, you know, I just kind of had this thought in the back of my mind while you were speaking. What kind of, you know, what are your thoughts on, you know, water from like other states or like other sources? You know, I know you kind of already started mentioning some of the solutions, which we'll get to in a little bit as well. But I just had like that thought in the back of my mind. What are your thoughts on that? You know, is that an idea that we should just throw out the window, or is there actually something to be talked about?
Well, that's great. I like it, Kevin. And I do think it is something to be talked about in terms of other states and then other sources from other states. There's a living example of it, of the Colorado, what's called the law of the river, which is referring to the Colorado River. And basically from the headwaters in the state of Colorado down through, I think it's seven of our western states, that river makes its magical journey. And then it ends in the Sea of Cortez with the country of Mexico having rights. But I think it's maybe a trickle of water that's actually getting all the way down to the tail end of the river that's available to another country. So what that says is one of two things. And one is there's not enough water for the states to even share with each other because they're worried about their own needs. And when you just look at the headline news from, you know, just recent months alone about the Colorado River, Lake Mead, Boy, is that making headline news left and right. And, you know, there's tribal organizations, sovereign nations as organized federally recognized tribes along the Colorado River. And I just saw something recently in the last couple of days where one of the tribes might be voluntarily availing itself to do conservation. And so I think that's a good example of entities, or in this instance, a sovereign nation trying to work with others and understand there is, we're all essentially in the same basket. There might be different seniorities under the law, but in terms of other states and sharing, it's more often than not, it's the other way around where they're in disputes. There are a number of federal cases that I could cite to, but I won't or you with that basically have states feuding with each other to create a new judgment that they would then have to operate by, or it's post-judgment, it's already been fought in the courts, but now there's a new dispute related to it coming up. So, but on the flip side, I'd like to be cautiously optimistic that, you know, there are instances where States can work together in 1 year, just like a transfer being done at a more micro level within a region or within our state, we'll do transfers. The same could be had where, okay, state such and such is not giving up its right, but will make available for this year water, which means it just stays in the river and flows down to that other state. There probably are examples of that having happened, but I'd like to think that could happen even more. In terms of other sources, the ocean comes to mind. And, you know, I've mentioned the recycled water, but there's only so many sources of water. The sky for snow and rain, recycling what we use here on the ground, and then obviously the groundwater itself. The ocean is another option. Other countries are far more advanced than we are, but we do have some here in California desalination plants. Southern California Edison, I believe, has operated a small desal plant on Catalina Island for a number of years, even decades. And more recently, at the end of 2015, I think it was, the Carlsbad plant came online in San Diego County as part of the San Diego County Water Authority and its member agencies, adding, I think, 7% to County Water Authority's portfolio, which I remember speaking on that day to have to talk about a success story. And I considered that a success story, and I still do. And I was challenged, why is that a success? It just came online. Well, look what went into it. It was a $1 billion project that brought public and private sectors together to finance it. The environmental issues were addressed and overcome. The state agencies each gave approval. And because it's along the coast or on the coast, that required Coastal Commission approvals as well, amongst other agencies. So to me, and the public got behind it. So it was a great example of all the different stakeholders and regulatory agencies, public and private, you know, creating more of a supply. Desal is a great potential source, but I also think it's you know, likely to be opposed on many levels. So there would have to be a huge appetite to take on a sizable desal project.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think it's really interesting. And it perfectly leads into the final question as we wrap up here, on what kind of solutions should we be looking at as a state? I know you mentioned desal, and you mentioned some of the other items. What other kinds of solutions are being discussed? And are there maybe any solutions or ideas that maybe haven't really, you know, there hasn't been much headway, but they're just kind of, you know, being discussed in maybe the science or engineering communities? You know, what have you been seeing in terms of addressing all the issues we've talked about today?
Sure. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, to reiterate what I would put into the solutions bucket, we've talked about a number of things in terms of, you know, really maximizing the water resource that we have by way of more efficient use, which means conservation, recycled water, desalination, those types of things. And one thing that I've alluded to a little bit here and there, but is very strongly a solution to me, is because, as I say, you can only conserve so much, and we can only reuse so much. So now you're with, what do we actually have? This is where I think the solution of markets comes into play, transferability. And so when I was talking about to Catherine's question about the states or I'm sorry, it was your question, Kevin, about other states and being able to, you know, share water. Well, sure, that would be a market transferability type concept. Or what I was referring to, you know, for transfers and keeping the cost down for customers, that's an example of a transfer, or the conserved water. But, you know, when we look at it, I think about it really very much in the groundwater context, but I think it applies in the surface water context as well. But let's keep it in the groundwater context, because I think markets have a place. Some markets within California water supply already exists. And examples of that would be particularly in groundwater basins that have been adjudicated. There's about 22 or so basins out of 127 that have been adjudicated in the state. And a handful of those who have been adjudicated have a lot of transfers that are done, because there's one groundwater user here who needs the water, another who has enough water for the year. And so they basically go through the process make that exchange, and it stays within the area. That last part that I just said, stays within the area, is what sells me from a legal perspective, from my own policy perspective, and my own defensibility. If I'm an advocate on behalf of a client for a transfer, I think that last part is key. It's staying within the area. But it doesn't have to be that to be a good transfer. I'll also say that. But staying within the area means, you know, it's basically percolating back into the ground or running back into that same stream system. For the most part, some of it's consumptively used, some of it's lost to evaporation. But let's say it's going elsewhere. I think that's fine too. If there's surplus water, it's certainly legally allowed. I think it's supportable, it's defensible, it's all of those things. And I've been a part of those to see the success with which it brings to both what I'll call the seller, but it's really transferor because it's a temporary basis, to the buyer or transferee that could be hundreds of miles away. Because of the win-win benefits that it brings. So to add to everything else we talked about, I would really say markets have a key place in the future of California water to create a nimbleness, yet have that tracking and help create win-win situations.
Definitely, Mr. Van, thank you so much. I think it's really interesting because, you know, I know we started the episode off with talking about, you know, how big of an issue this is and why we should be talking about it and why it affects all of us. But on the other hand, it's really great to know that there are, you know, a variety of solutions. And maybe, you know, not any single one of these could address every single problem that we discussed. But the fact that there are so many amazing people like yourself working on it and you know, tackling the issue from multiple perspectives, the scientific, the engineering, and also the policy and legal aspects. It's good to hear that there are, you know, avenues as to which that the state and also, you know, as individual Californians and you know, work to a, you know, working solution that keeps as many people as possible happy, but while also addressing the fact that, you know, are in a state that unfortunately has been suffering a lot of droughts very recently. And like you mentioned earlier, it's looking like this could continue. And there really is, you know, we can't bet on, you know, great rainfall or snowfall next year, and that we actually have to be not as reactionary, but more, you know, actually going after and pursuing feasible solutions. So it's really, really great to hear. It was fantastic to learn about water and, you know, especially in the Inland Empire and Riverside, it's such an important issue. So it was fantastic having you on. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Well, you're very welcome, and it was my privilege, really quite flattering to be here and be back with UC Riverside. And again, kudos to you both. Your great reflection on not only the School of Public Policy and the university, but you do have the minds to generate solutions, the voices to get the message out there. So please keep doing what you're doing.
This podcast is a production of the UC Riverside School of Public Policy. Our theme music was produced by C. Codane. I'm Kevin Karami. Till next time.